Today is my final episode of Backchat, and to end, I've decided to focus on an important topic that doesn't often get the light of day. The plight of minority communities across the world is well documented in the media, but very often there is a lack of coverage about dissenters within these communities. We often look at minority groups as if they were a homogenous bloc and ignore dissenting voices in these communities that are often silenced by those that are at the head of these communities. Today's podcast, with a very special guest, will hopefully provide a voice to these people. I'm Mihir Joshi, and for the very last time, this is Backchat.
Here now with more news, debate, and opinion.
Today on Backchat, we have a very special guest, who is Mariam Namazi, spokesperson for the One Law for All campaign. How are you doing today, Mariam?
Hi, Mihir. I'm fine, thank you. And thanks very much for having me on your program.
It's our pleasure. We always love to get, you know, some interesting different points of view on. And I know full well that a lot of the Backbench listeners will really, really enjoy listening to you talk about the stuff we're going to talk about later.
Great. So
I wanted to kind of begin by just asking quite a personal question about your activism. So obviously you're a very well-known activist that's done a lot of things such as nude protests and, you know, campaigned heavily for like women's rights. What was the moment you would say that you realized you wanted to be an activist?
I'm not sure I'm very well known, but thank you for that. but I would say, you know, I don't think anybody really sets out to be an activist. It's not really a career choice, basically, where people sort of think about what they want to be when they grow up and think, oh, I want to be an activist. I think it's sort of, you know, life circumstances as well as realities that you're faced with leads you to a position where you feel, you know, things are unfair, there's something wrong, and you sort of just start speaking out against it and trying to take action against it. And eventually, if you do that for long enough, then you become, or you're known as an activist, really. But I think we're all really activists in various ways, in the sense of, you know, taking action when something's not quite right, whether it's in our universities or at our workplaces or in the home, in our neighborhoods. And I think for me, because that was coupled with having to leave my country, Iran, where I was originally born and raised, you know, I did start by becoming a refugee rights activist without really thinking I was an activist, but just doing that. And then I guess when you do refugee rights work, you do often think about why people are fleeing. It's not enough just to help people who fled, but it's also to start challenging the reasons why people flee, including myself, my family members, and also I guess that's when I started focusing on Islam, Islamic states, the Iranian regime, and of course then, you know, defending rights, but also things that help respect rights to some extent, and that's universalism, secularism, and, you know, sort of freedoms and rights that lots of people take for granted, but that don't really exist for a lot of people across the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned secularism there. I mean, my next question was literally that I had prepared was about secularism. So, I mean, what is it for you that makes secularism one of the core values that we ought to strive for as a global community?
Yeah, I mean, I think, of course, secularism is not the end all of everything. I mean, it's really, to me, it's just a very minimal starting point. It's a sort of minimum precondition. And basically all it is, it's a framework which says that religion has to be separate from the state and public policy, the law, the educational system, as a way of actually safeguarding rights. And I think in a sense, if we look at the numbers of people trying to flee to reach Western societies, really, I think that is the most positive defense of secularism that exists in the world today, because people are not trying to flee to Saudi Arabia, or they're not.
Yeah.
flee to Iran, unless, of course, it's a border country and they've got no other place to go to. You know, obviously, people will go to border countries, but in the end, they want to come to societies where religion is separate from the state to a large extent. And I think, you know, it is really a basic minimum and a precondition. And I think facts prove that, you know, the evidence is there that where there are secular societies, though there are so many problems still, as we know, in Britain, in the United States, in Europe, in Australia, and so on. Even so, what we see is that there are more rights respected, there are more freedoms available. And in a sense, you know, you see women's rights are more respected, gay rights are more respected, you know, minority rights are more respected. So it is a basic framework. And I think it's important if one wants to defend people's rights and people's freedoms, I think secularism has to be one of the key structures that we need to really fight for. And I know, of course, Britain is not a secular society in the sense that we still have an established church. The Queen is the head of the Church of England, for example. We've got bishops in the House of Lords. Prayers and all of that. But nonetheless, the society is secularized. And I think that is very key, you know, for respective rights. So I look at it from that way. Like, I really think secularism is a human rights issue. It should be a human rights demand. And unfortunately, it's not in the way that it should be.
I mean, it's really interesting that you mentioned Islam in your first kind of sentence, because one of the questions I had prepared was, it seems to me at least that a lot of people are very scared to discuss topics such as secularism, women's rights, and free speech, especially in the context of Islam. Why do you think this is? I mean, one of the things that I learned from your TED talk at Warwick was the amount of censorship that goes on under the name of blasphemy. Why do you think there's this kind of hostile atmosphere when it comes to discussing these critical issues, especially in the context of Islam?
I mean, I think there's quite a few reasons. One, I think, is purely fear, because there is, you know, the risk of violence, or at least the threat of violence, if criticism of Islam takes place. So, you know, oftentimes if I go and speak somewhere, the first thing I hear is that it's a security risk. And this sort of conflation of criticism of an idea, which after all, that's all religion is. It's an idea, it's a belief, sacred to some, but not sacred to others, that it's equated with a security risk, again, shows how fundamentally there is this, you know, climate of fear around speaking on Islam in particular. And also, of course, here in the West, we know that it's very often linked to a defense of minority rights, censoring criticism of Islam as a defense of the so-called Muslim minority. And I guess the question there is, why is, you know, a criticism of a belief an attack on a minority? It's not. Because first of all, not every minority thinks the same. Even those who come from Muslim backgrounds might be critical of religious beliefs, of the societies or communities that they were raised in, of their families that they were raised in. They might, even if they're believers, they might not necessarily agree with the Islam as it's being promoted and imposed by the religious right, the Islamists. And of course, there's so many free thinkers and secularists and atheists and ex-Muslims from those so-called communities and societies as well. You know, so I think part of the reason why it's also looked at in this way is because we are living in a climate now where we're seeing the rise of the religious right. And that's not just the Islamists, but the Hindu right in India, the Buddhist right in Myanmar or Sri Lanka, the Jewish right in the Palestinian territories, the Christian right in some countries in the African continent or in the United States, for example, also in Europe. And so I think within that context, criticism of religion is becoming more and more difficult. And within that context is becoming more difficult. With regards to Islam, if you add to it the terrorism and the terror, you know, the fact that people can get killed for writing a book or drawing a cartoon, and also this equation of it being anti-minorities, you see why it becomes so difficult to have this conversation. I think what's important to say here is that, of course, racism is abhorrent and it has to be condemned and stood up against. But, you know, imposing blasphemy doesn't stop racism. It doesn't stop bigotry. And we have to see that there's a distinction between blasphemy and bigotry against believers. And I think that's one of the areas that I've been trying to work on and also try to raise, you know, highlight, because what happens to those of us from Muslim backgrounds that don't agree with apostasy and blasphemy laws? You know, we can be killed in over a dozen countries because we've left Islam or because we've criticized Islam. Do we not also have a right to talk about that? Of course we do, you know, and I think it's important to highlight that and to defend dissenters from minority backgrounds.
I mean, absolutely. It's a very thorough answer. I mean, just to add to that, you've worked with the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain, which is, you know, an organization that does fantastic work to help people who have, you know, who've decided to leave Islam. I think one of the questions I guess I had was, what is the importance of such an organization? Is there really what's the climate of intimidation that ex-Muslims can face?
Look, I think it's really important in the same way that having gay pride is important. You know, your sexuality might be your own business. It's nobody else's business. But if you're going to be discriminated against because of it, if you can be killed for it, then obviously you come out and show that you're gay. You try to open up the space so that it's normal and people see that there is nothing abnormal or wrong with being gay. And it's the same with this ex-Muslim movement and the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain, which I started 12 years ago. The idea is that, look, of course, you know, the fact that we're atheists from Muslim backgrounds, the fact that we're critics of Islam and of all religions, is our personal belief in the same way that someone might be a Muslim or Jewish or what have you, or Christian, Hindu. But the point is that because, you know, there are laws in over a dozen countries where apostasy and blasphemy is punishable by death, all of them Islamic, because so many people, including in Britain, face honor-based violence and threats because of their atheism and their free thinking, that it's important to come out publicly to open up the space, to say that we dissenters, we free thinkers, we Islam's non-believers, we exist, that there are many of us, and we have a right to live and think the way we want without threats and fear and intimidation. And so I think from that perspective, it's a form of survival, you know, when you're always constantly being erased from the public space, from your families, from your societies, from any conversation or discussion on the so-called Muslim community or so-called Muslim societies, then it's also a way of resistance. You know, people will say, well, you've left Islam, why don't you just shut up and move on? But the fact of the matter is, because it's still so difficult to move on, because so many people are still in hiding, they're in the closet, they're fearful for their lives, you know, we can't shut up and move on, because it's impossible to do that. And the only way we can sort of help to move this conversation along is to open it up, raise it, even if it's uncomfortable for people to hear. It is part of our lives and our stories, and we have a right to express it and to create space for people to be able to live in the way that they want. I think it's a perfectly, you know, it's just something that lots of human rights activism has resulted in, you know, opening up the space for gay people, opening up the space for women to vote, opening up the space for black people to sit at counters with white people in the United States as a result of the civil rights movement, you know, and this is just one of those other movements that are important.
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely something that shocked me to know that the scale of honour-based violence, especially in the United Kingdom. I mean, we see ourselves as a society that is progressive and that is advanced, and yet a lot of our, say, politicians and other human rights activists seem to turn a blind eye to things like honour-based violence. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's purely because it puts them in a very difficult position, as per, like, because they want to be seen as protecting minority rights, but then at the same time, it's difficult for them? Or do you think they're just purely hypocritical? I mean, that's the second view is the view I hold.
That they're hypocritical?
Yeah.
Is that? Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is that there's a blind eye, they say, because they don't want to promote discrimination in a so-called minority community. This is the excuse that they give. And so, for example, we've heard a police commissioner saying that they can't target FGM because it would be seen as being discriminatory against a community. Now, this is really bogus, because the fact of the matter is the person who's facing honor-based violence, or the person who's facing FGM, is also from that minority community. So mm-hmm. really what the government is saying is that it prefers to protect those in power in the minority community, those who are the gatekeepers of that so-called community. And I don't even, you know, use the term community, because in a sense, a lot of it is constructed, isn't it? There is no Muslim community. It's not a homogenous community by any means. And homogenizing it is one of the ways in which the government allows itself the right to sort of turn its face away, or give it, a blind spot, exactly, on this issue. You know, I think it's because they don't really care about minorities. If we look at how, for example, the Windrush generation has been treated in this country, how refugees mm-hmm. and immigrants have been treated in this country, you know, how much hate has been promoted, not by far-right parties, but by the government itself against immigrants. You know, basically, mm-hmm. UKIP is no longer needed anymore, because the Tory party's saying exactly the same things that UKIP mm-hmm. has been saying about immigrants, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I know we've got a little break in that, because obviously all the people who are such a high percentage of Black and minority ethnic groups, as they call it, BMEs, are on the front lines of fighting COVID-19, that mm-hmm. suddenly everybody's clapping for the NHS and for, you know, minority doctors and nurses. So we've got a break from that hate for a little while. And we're actually seeing the real face of immigrants and minorities in this country, because mm-hmm. for this brief moment. So I think part of it is they don't really care. And I think really it goes back to, or it's a continuation, in my opinion, of, you know, colonial policies. You know, mm-hmm. it's this sort of divide and rule, divide citizens, because after all, whether you're a minority or not, whether you were born in this country or immigrated here, we are all citizens. But it's interesting how minorities in this country still are considered separate communities that need to be managed by increasingly religious organizations. So, you know, the Muslim Council of Britain, and then you've got the Sikh group dealing with the Sikhs, and the Hindu group dealing with the Hindus, and all of these mm-hmm. interfaith coalitions. So I think part of it is because it is a cheap way of managing your citizens by relegating them to minority communities, and leaving the management of those communities on the cheap to, self-appointed parasitical community leaders. And I think that's really a very much a continuation of colonial policies. And I think that's really why they don't care. And it is, you know, you do see this sort of attitude of different people having different value and worth, particularly the way, you know, poor people are treated, working class people are treated, and minorities are treated. So I think, in a sense, the whole worry about discrimination and racism is really a cover to promote their discriminatory and racist policies.
It's a very interesting viewpoint. I just wanted to move on to talk about Iran, because I think this is something that doesn't get discussed often in the news, unless it's, you know, something to do with something the Americans have done or something like that. I just wanted to talk about the situation on the ground in Iran. I mean, I saw that over the past year, there have been protests against the regime. Do you think more and more ordinary Iranians are getting fed up of Ayatollah Khomeini and his Islamist regime? Do you think there's a groundswell of resistance to the regime?
I think there's definitely a huge, massive, both anti-Islamic backlash and an anti-Islamist backlash in Iran. And I think this is and has been ongoing. In a sense, I feel that the Iranian revolution, the 1979 revolution, which was basically expropriated by the Islamic movement because it wasn't an Islamic revolution, is still unfinished. And I think the protests of new generations of Iranians is continuing that fight for, you know, basic fundamental rights and freedoms. I do think that, in Iran, 75% of the population is under the age of 30. So you've got a very young population, and very much so they come face to face with Islamic laws in their basic daily lives. So Islamic laws are very much antithetical to 21st century living. So, and when you've got a young population as well, you know, and walking hand in hand with your loved one, your lover, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, whatever, is illegal. Listening to music is illegal. Having sex outside of marriage is illegal. Dancing is illegal. Wearing what you want is illegal. When you've got a situation where everything you're doing is illegal, you know, in the sense of a 21st century life, you do find that even very basic things of, you know, wearing your hijab back or wanting to remove it becomes a direct confrontation and challenge with Islamic laws and the state. And so I think that's why we constantly keep seeing these protests. And of course, add to that the immense poverty, the fact that there's high rates of unemployment. And in a country that's very rich in oil and resources, you can see how it becomes very explosive over time. So I do think that there is this ongoing protest. It does get suppressed with immense brutality. And then it rears its head up again. So it is, you know, an ongoing challenge. The problem, I think, is that if people in Iran were supported, and I'm not talking by Donald Trump, which is part, I think, really no different from the Islamic regime, in my opinion, in the sense of the reaction that they can impose on a society if they have the power to do it and when they do. But I think people-to-people solidarity is hugely important, you know, to sort of support people's movement there and also put pressure on governments to stop supporting the Islamic regime so that people are able to basically end what they've started and they keep starting over the decades.
I mean, it was interesting you mentioned the media in the last question. I think it's... Like I said, I don't think the media, I don't recall seeing a lot of news articles or news reports on the protests. Whereas when the Americans killed Qasem Soleimani, for example, back in January, the Western media continued to show footage of the funeral processions without mentioning the fact that, you know, many of the people had actually been coerced by the regime to being there. Do you think such coverage, such as the coverage of Soleimani and his funeral processions, do you think that's really irresponsible of organizations like the BBC, Sky, CNN, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely. I think one of the things with the BBC, we call them Ayatollah BBC in Iran because they always somehow end up supporting the regime. I'm not sure how they manage that, but especially BBC Farsi. But I think, you know, the issue is that definitely you have governments and very often media outlets sort of representing government views to some extent, which are really mainstream views. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, when you look at someone like Soleimani, well, first of all, what was he doing in Iraq in the first place? Mm-hmm. And also, what is the U.S. doing in Iraq in the first place? You know, mm-hmm. the fact that they're two reactionary forces vying for power in the region and making the lives of Iraqi people completely bleak and miserable. Both the U.S. militarism and the Islamic regime's militarism. It's not just the U.S. that is a force of imperialism. Mm-hmm. Islamism is a force of imperialism in our region, in the Middle East and North Africa. And I think, you know, the fact that he was hailed as a hero when he's really a criminal, a war criminal, not mm-hmm. just for what he's done in Iraq, but also what he and his forces have done in Iran. The Revolutionary Guards, the Pasdaran that he heads, has also killed so many protesters in Iran and been a key pillar of the suppression of the population there, the protesters there, the dissenters there. So I think obviously the coverage is never fair. The only thing that we have in our favor, I think, whether it be Iranian protesters, whether it be ex-Muslims, trying to defend their right to free thought, whether it's women who want to oppose Sharia courts, we have the internet. And I think in a way the internet has created a playing field, level the playing field to some extent, and given us the opportunity to have our voices heard in a way that we could never have dreamed of being possible. And of course, it's also being used to promote fake news. It's also being used to promote and organize the far right and the fascists and the white supremacists. But also it is anything in society, there's always fight back and push back taking place too. So I think for those who want to support the people's movements, who want to support dissenters and free thinkers, the internet is a really good place to start to link up with people, to support them, to promote the protests and get that heard, you know. And I think a lot of the protests have come, for example, to your attention, to everyone's attention, because of social media. So we need to mm-hmm. think of ways in which we can support these movements in practical ways.
Yeah, absolutely. This links perfectly onto my final question, which is, for a lot of people listening, you know, you said at the start that we can all be activists of some form or another. What do you think is the easiest thing people can do to support your campaigns and, you know, the values that you stand for? I mean, we kind of touched on it before, like linking up over the internet and stuff. What else is there that we can do to help support women's rights and secularism?
I think, you know, there's everybody will know what ways they can get involved. And there's so many different ways one can get involved. Talking to friends and neighbors about this issue, talking to family members, people at your workplace, at your universities, in classes, raising and highlighting, you know, the dissenters, raising and highlighting the voice of those who are protesting, those who are refusing and resisting, because what often happens is that we only hear the voice of those in power often, and those who are trying to suppress dissent and protest. So highlighting it, even something as simple as retweeting an action, promoting it on your Facebook page, getting support for these issues. It could include signing a petition, joining a solidarity action or campaign. Just last week, we had a 3-hour live stream protest in support of Sohail Arabi, who was on death row on blasphemy charges in Iran. And now he's still in prison and been tortured because of his refusal to be silent. You know, he's still writing open letters from prison, asking for people to support him and political prisoners in Iran. So something as simple as that, joining that. And his family, for example, heard about the protest. It gives them courage. It encourages them in the same way that we get encouraged and feel more courageous when we hear about the work being done elsewhere. So I think it is about creating this mass movement. And for that, we can all play a little part. It does make a huge difference. Every little bit helps. And I think that's what we have to keep reminding ourselves. Every little bit helps. And together, we can change things in the same way that things have been changed throughout history that allows us the opportunities and rights we have today that are, you know, a few generations ago, even 50 years ago, 40 years ago, was impossible to fathom.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So that concludes our interview today. Thank you very much for coming on, Mariam. It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's been very, very informative.
Thank you, Meher, for having me. It's been a great pleasure also, and wishing you the best of luck in these very difficult times.
Thank you very much. Same to you.